is the stamp of neoliberalism, the culture of hyper-individualism, everyone special.
Welcome back to Not Nutrition Gurus. I'm your host, Rachel Hunter, where we are firmly planted in the unsexy, nuanced middle ground of the health and fitness industry. Please keep your arms, hands, and feet inside the vehicle at all times. And remember, no gurus allowed. Bonjour, mon petit pois. How are we all today? I hope that you're doing exceptionally well. And if you're not, I hope it passes soon. So this is the part two of my two-part series with Dr. Alan Flanagan. If you haven't listened to part one, I would highly recommend it. It's just a very interesting look at why nutrition as a science seems to be so up for grabs. It's like, as a society, we love to just cannibalize on nutrition and the zealots that perpetuate just wild and, you know, poorly or unfounded claims. And in this episode, Alan and I talk about neoliberalism, privilege, vegetarians versus omnivores. Are appetite suppressant medications the fall of Western society as we know it? Is personalized nutrition a scam? Is coaching a scam? Is good intent enough? And we also talk drag queens and Margaret Thatcher. And Alan also name drops a whole bunch of companies. So the upside for me is that he's a lawyer, which means that he has now made himself Not Nutrition Guru's legal team should any of these companies decide to come and cancel me. So I'm really excited for Alan and his continued pro bono work in law. But this is an exceptionally good episode. Just to catch you up, because obviously I broke this up from part one, we sort of jump in with talking about how you can pick and pull apart different studies and different meta-analysis and why methodologies are important. And I kind of start off the conversation with breaking down studies between vegetarians and omnivores. So without further ado, on to the podcast.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when I started, I guess, like, generally kind of like nerding out on this kind of stuff, and I was like, is it actually just a calorie deficit, you guys? Because, like, surely this isn't the end of the road, because this feels fucking stupid. This feels reductionist. I reject that, and I'm going to go.
Yeah.
And now trip and fall down a however many year long rabbit hole instead. But, you know, I think, God, I can't remember the study, but it was, you know, comparing vegetarians to omnivores. And the initial study, when you read through it, it's like, oh, well, vegetarians are healthier. And then they did another study, like they had another go around at it. And they're sort of like, well, we're recruiting these vegetarians from, like, outdoor
the vegetarian
stores,
society, yeah,
or right, yeah, outdoor stores, camping gear, yeah, or like health food stores. Like, that's where we recruited these people, so they already have quote unquote health seeking behaviors. So then if we go back, if we double down and go find meat eaters who also eat lots of vegetables, because again, we can't escape that, and then they also have health-seeking behaviors. Whereas if you compare vegetarian to like 1985 VP of sales with 12 cigars a day, 3 like rare steaks a week, yeah, the outcomes are going to be very different if you're out hiking mountains every weekend and getting in your broccoli versus smoking cigars, eating lots of saturated fat, and never leaving your desk. The outcomes are going to be different, but which, you know, again, it's sort of like zooming back out and going, is it you being a vegetarian that is quote unquote healthier, or is it the whole picture? And I think that, you know, that's, we do keep coming back to this, like, yeah, eat lots of vegetables, It's a really fucking good idea. Mm-hmm. Eat lean proteins. Another really fucking good idea. Limit saturated fats. Another stellar idea. And actually, you know, whenever I have one friend who's always like, yeah, but Rach, what about the blue zones? They smoke. And I'm like, for God's sake, if you want a reason to keep smoking cigarettes, fucking, I don't care. It's not, your lungs are not my lungs. Do whatever you want. Do whatever makes you happy, hon. Like,
yeah,
not my circus, not my monkeys. But if we look at blue zones, like, again, they eat carbohydrates, you guys. So like, don't worry. No one's coming for your pasta. Like, eat pasta. It's fine. But it's also very much like we're eating a variety of vegetables, but also in blue zones, they live in like tepid climates. So from nothing else, vitamin D exposure, and also they can go outside year round and go for a walk. In all of the places where they're blue zones, women are safe to walk outside on their own. That makes a fucking difference. Also, we value
community fabric.
Exactly. They value the elderly, where we do not have that necessarily in quote unquote our community. Obviously, subcultures within Western societies, depending on what your nationality is, will be very, very different. Or if you're from like immigrant families and things like that. Generally speaking, white people don't really have that kind of culture in Western society where we like are going to move our parents in and like make sure that they're cared and looked after. Also low stress. Also, you know, like it's just sort of like, yes, and maybe a couple of them are the exception to the rule and have had a cigarette until they're 95. But are you looking at the big picture of what their lives actually looked like? Because again, like you said, we know eating vegetables is just a really fucking good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can't get away from that.
Yeah, there's a bunch of intangibles that will likely never be able to adjust for in a study. Because how do you measure it? How do you measure a sense of community? How do you measure a sense of stress? So did you ever hear of the Rosetta Project? So this is really cool. This is, I think actually it's, oh no, it's not Connecticut. Sorry, it's Pennsylvania. So in the 70s, there was a round of census taking in the US, and the census statisticians noticed that there was what appeared to be an anomaly, which was a town called Rosetta in Pennsylvania that had these apparently coronary heart disease rates, which were very high in the 1970s, well below the national average. And all the towns around Rosetta had coronary heart disease rates at the national average. So they were like, okay, this is even an anomaly in the regional. It's not like this is just a region where people are dying less. So a group of researchers went out, published an initial paper, and then they did a 50-year follow-up, which was published, I think, in like 2009, maybe. But basically, when they got to the town, the town was one of these immigrant towns where a town in Sicily had literally like displaced itself to the US at some point. So the town was almost exclusively Italian American, mostly from the same kind of families, very close knit. You know, the kind of classic story of no one locked their door at night, a lot of community involvement, a lot of intergenerational involvement. All the men technically had excess adiposity and smoked cigars, yet they weren't having heart disease at the rates of the national average. And ultimately, and again, you know, research methods have come along a long way. What they attributed it to in the original paper was just lack of stress and low crime rates and these kind of like factors that made your day-to-day life there a very stress-free existence. And at the time, there was a big focus on like stress as it might be a factor like leading to heart disease in Western countries. So what was actually quite prescient is in their conclusions in the original paper, the researchers predicted that as the town became more, quote, Americanized, that anomaly of lower heart disease rates would be abolished over time, would eradicate. And at the 50-year follow-up, that was precisely what was shown, that their heart disease rates had now become as the town became Americanized, essentially, were just right sitting where the national average was. And I always find that it's a bit fluffy sometimes, I think, as a story, because it's difficult to tell people now to just constitute themselves in a really robust community. Kind of, you know, I think there's limits to, and I'm conscious that particularly in nutrition, even in academic nutrition, there's this weird cottage core kind of push now for everyone to be like growing their own vegetables and like return to nature and let's just get women back in the kitchen and cooking meals from scratch and this is how we'll reverse. And I'm really sensitive to that rhetoric because I think it's weird and kind of dystopian. But I still think there's a lesson in that, in the Rosetto kind of tale, about the role of these intangible factors that we'll never be able to adjust for, we'll never be able to control for in an intervention. And these are factors that clearly have an enormous influence on people's health over the course of their lifespan. So I think for, yeah, your point about zooming back out, more than any subject I can think of is quite critical for nutrition, particularly when, as you know, I kind of beat on a socioeconomic drum a lot when it comes to nutrition and diet. And it's always almost exclusively white male PTs with their abs out that are the ones that are like hardcore pushing back on, well, people can just boil rice, or well, people can just, well, personal responsibility, make your bed in the morning, Jordan Peterson said so. Like, it's a boring conversation because as if there isn't evidence in relation to all of this stuff, right? It's as if a whole, you know, area of nutrition science is dedicated to understanding the socioeconomics of diet and health. And we know a lot of stuff from that research area, and it's interesting stuff. Again, there's a lot that's difficult to control for, but you zoom out and you realize just how many factors combine to act as a barrier to an individual. Just eating a better diet sounds great. Like perishability of food, preparation skills, time. Like if it's a parental household, is it a single parent household or a two parent household? Like, how many kids are there? What are the kids' preferences? They're hugely deterministic. You know, we'll just make them eat vegetables. It's not going to fucking work if you're on a tight budget and the priority is actually just feeding the kids.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have time. You don't have the fucking luxury to be like, well, kids, you know, eat your veg first. Like, so.
Well, and it's just, you know, you guys have never walked into a food bank before, have you? You know, it doesn't look like a grocery store. You know what I mean? And I think nor have you ever served dinner at a homeless shelter. You know, it's just sort of, you're so disconnected from the people that you are disparaging.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you see, like, I would like to think that it's fewer that are, have ill intent than there are the people who have good intent.
Mm-hmm.
But good intent doesn't mean you're not fucking stupid, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's, you know, kind of like what we've alluded to, I suppose, in this podcast, where it's sort of like, nutrition research, you can't actually just pick it up and be like, aha, I have fully understood everything in here. I can, you know, speak to it to, like, you can't pick up one study and necessarily be better off. Mm-hmm. It's a case of, you kind of have to stick with it and read a whole bunch more and probably speak to people who do it as a job, because you have to have some ridiculous ego to think that you can just read nutrition research and just understand it on your own. And if you are that person, good for you. I am not. I quite happily hand over my money to help understand, make sure that I'm giving like the best information to my clients. But it's sort of, yeah, there is this huge disconnect from the people that the 18-year-old personal trainers are telling just to work harder. What I often find, this is a little bit of a tangent, but the coping mechanisms or when my clients may have gained the weight, quote, the weight, right? I often work with phallus clients. It's not the most important thing. I don't like people want to lose fat. Great. If they don't, I don't really care. My job is not to tell you what to do. It's just how to get you from where you are to where you want to be. But oftentimes it's their coping mechanisms are still just kicking around from when they were in single parent households, or they face some sort of adversity, or that, you know, it's, so it's sort of like you kind of have to be in a position where you are, quote, privileged enough to be able to sort of like relearn and unlearn new beliefs and old beliefs and take enough time to implement them, because knowledge is not enough to implement them. I love that you went on a nice little tangent about how difficult behavior change is. For all of my clients listening, it's not just me that's saying these things, right? Like, it's not me trying to placate you or patronize you. It is fucking hard. And you can't copy and paste what was discovered in a lab, because you don't live in a lab.
No.
You live in the real world. And that's exactly what makes it extremely difficult to sustain any kind of change at all, but especially around food.
Yeah. And this is why a free living, you know, randomized controlled trial in nutrition really just isn't doing what it thinks it's doing, because you've got huge dropout rates because behavior change is hard and sucks. Then you've got a question over, if people did change the behavior, how long did that last? Like a month or two? And then you see adherence just drop off. Then there's the question of whatever background changes they made as well. You're asking someone, oh, we want you to consume 4 tablespoons of olive oil and 1 ounce of nuts every day. Cool. But like, are you assuming that every other aspect of their diet has remained constant throughout the intervention, such that they've only added tablespoons of olive oil and nuts? Like, these assumptions are just insane when you think about it. When you know nutrition, you know behavior change, and you say out loud what these trials are assuming they've achieved, and you're like, are you out of your fucking mind? And then drawing these conclusions that their modified Mediterranean diet or whatever they thought they did is, you know, lowering cardiovascular disease. Or this even applies to like the control groups, and we're gonna tell people these big Mediterranean diet trials have been conducted in Spain. They're taking people who naturally consume about 42% of their daily energy from fat. That's a generally high fat diet.
That's pretty chunky.
UK is about 33, right?
Yep.
They're already consuming essentially your fucking Mediterranean diet. And then they're telling them to go on a low fat diet, which is not even culturally resembling their habitual day-to-day diet. And then what you have in that group is more than the intervention group, because all you're asking your intervention group to do is be a bit more Mediterranean than they already fucking are. And then your control group are the ones with more dropouts, shit adherence, don't meet any of their diet targets. And then you're saying, wow, look at how good our intervention was. And it's like, was it that good, or was your control group just shit? Like, so yeah. Yeah. And I get more information, so to speak, about how hard behavior change is with nutrition from control groups, not intervention groups, in these big trials, because the control groups are asking people to do what most people think they have to do in day-to-day life, which is adopt a fucking diet they don't want to do, changing parameters of diet they've no interest in changing, and then they never meet any of their targets for whatever the diet is that we can do, you know. And yeah, behavior change is hard enough, but behavior change, when you're trying to adopt behaviors you've no fucking interest in adopting, have no motivation to adopt, have nothing enjoyable about the process of trying to adopt these behaviors, there's no low-hanging fruit of reward being like, oh, you know what, this is difficult, but I'm enjoying this. Like, there's nothing. So of course people get frustrated, drop out, or just completely throw in the towel, say fuck it, and just go hog on fucking cake or whatever, which is really a valid response to trying to eat cardboard or whatever behavior change someone is trying to make. So yeah, I think, you know, I think I get a lot of value out of looking at the control groups in some of these trials as a way of inferring just how difficult behavior change is when the behavior you're being asked to do is really something you don't really have much interest in doing. You have people typically with this kind of health stuff have an interest in an outcome.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to lose weight, or they want to lower their blood pressure, or they want to lower their cholesterol. They're only really interested in the outcome. But they're told certain behaviors are going to get them there. So this diet change or this lifestyle change is going to get them there. And that's where they fall, because they're after the outcome, but the process that they end up adopting to get there is what's bullshit, you know? And that's that kind of disconnect between the outcome and the method of getting to that outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is something that I must speak to with, you know, clients and or people like, hey, Rach, can I ask you a question about XYZ? Sure, I'm off the clock, but why not? It's sort of like in a study, oftentimes they're, you know, it is looking at the physiological side of it, you know, high fat versus high carb versus, you know, whatever. Like there is a variable, and you're trying to look at these different people and how it affects them. But ultimately, like you just said, if you don't want to do it, just because someone had, quote, success when they were in a clinical trial doing said thing, does not mean, not clinical trial, but like control trial, does not mean that if you were like, God, that sounds terrible, but if it got me the outcome I'm after, that's exactly how I'm going to proceed. It's like, no, there's more than one, you know, more than one way to skin a cat, more than one road to Rome. Like, it's not, we could get you there, but try not to get too caught up in picking things you actively will hate and give up on, and then shame and guilt spiral yourself into oblivion because you're not actually further to where you want to be. Mm. You just hate yourself. But the way you, like, again, sort of face value interpreted that, quote, data is, well, yeah, but it works. Therefore, I just have to contort myself into that thing to get what I want because I want the same outcome. It's like, you don't actually.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's the nice, like, Puritan hangover where the harder you work, the closer to God you are, and whatever it is. I mean, that's definitely a prevalent sort of like cultural hangover, I think, in America.
In America.
That's my humble opinion.
I think here, I think in the UK, it's a cultural hangover, not of Puritanism, but of Thatcherism. And so,
well, yeah, then, yeah.
but it is, and I see this all over the health space, is the stamp of neoliberalism, the culture of hyper individualism, everyone's special. This is why I love really pushing the whole kind of diet guidelines thing. And I'm like, but tell me why this isn't good enough for you. And what they can't, you know the answer. The answer is because they're so fucking special. They actually, the guidelines are for 97.5% of the population. I'm not, of course you're not, you know. So I'm going to make like a copy of the Eat Well guide that on the top has like a bit to fill in someone's name. And it'd be like, now it's individual.
It's a personalized meal plan.
You can put your name on it because you're so special and you need, yeah. And so, I mean, that's my cynicism really coming through here with a lot of this. But like, this is the neoliberalism of health is stamped all over health culture and nutrition in a big way. It is this emphasis on hyper-individualism, personal responsibility, fetishization, and exists in this context where society doesn't exist as a concept, because within the neoliberal kind of model, it's like the market replaces society. So everyone is now just an individual unit of consumption and production in this model. And you don't owe, there's no such kind of thing. There's no concept of reciprocal responsibility. Or, and I think this is obviously then why we have so many of the narratives we do about poverty and diet, about access, resources, and diet. Because the idea that anyone owes anyone anything in this kind of culture is anathema to the culture itself, because it's all at the level of the individual. It's all, this is your responsibility. You're the reason you're unhealthy. We see this play out with even GLP-1 analog, you know, semaglutide, the conversation. I'm still astounded to read articles by some idiot in a newspaper about, right, like, there's a Times columnist called Matthew Saeed, and he wrote one of the most breathtakingly ignorant articles I've ever read about semaglutide, where he's basically like, this is the downfall of the West. And it's like, you know, I'd say Russia probably are a bigger problem than a fucking, you know, this.
Have you heard fucking, of Putin?
Yeah, this insane rhetoric of how, you know, this is what does this do to Wilbur? And it's like, they wouldn't talk about statins in that way. They wouldn't talk about insulin in that way. You wouldn't talk about any other drug for a condition in this way. So explain to me what the difference is. And you scratch at that and you realize that they're making a moral distinction, not a biological distinction.
Yep.
And this absurd idea that this is this level of individual, you know, you owe, there is no such thing to society. So society doesn't owe you anything, but you owe yourself to be healthy, you know, and it translates into some really kind of weird ways that we frame health and nutrition.
Yeah, there's two things that I would like to take and run with. First is a little tangent, and the other one I wrote down so I don't forget. But before we started recording, I said to you that I was on a second date with a man who, for whatever reason, had qualified as a personal trainer and then started talking about my job, went on a long tangent about how GLP-1s and appetite suppressants are an easy out, in which I proceeded to argue with said man for about 2 hours. And to be fair, as I was sitting there, I was like, God, he must really be into me because I am just laying into him. And again, it really is this sort of like, he's like, well, I helped someone lose about 4 stone once. And then when I stopped helping him, he just gained it all back. And I was like, so surely that is proof that it is exceptionally difficult. And the fact that you have no skills in behavior change psychology or motivational interviewing blew past any sense of autonomy for this man and just did everything for him and then got frustrated when he didn't do it for himself. Like, you idiot, you just proved my point.
Yeah. But this is it. This is inevitably that line of thinking will trip itself up.
Yeah, exactly.
Inevitably it will trip itself up. And it's funny, it's there's this expectation that people in certain circumstances will do things that the generally comfortable, posh, well-off, usually male critic of whatever it is wouldn't do themselves if they were in the same situation.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way, you know. And you're telling me if you know, if one of these, like Matthew Saeed, happened to balloon up to, I don't know, fucking 120 kilos, that he and just found himself and ravenous the whole day, like, you're telling me he wouldn't use a GLP-1 and you know, wouldn't be straight on semaglutide and helping himself to achieve possibly one of the most difficult outcomes in biological sciences?
Like, yeah.
Name a more difficult outcome. Like, I think about this in relation to, say, my real pet interest is cardiovascular disease. The fucking drugs that are available now for cardiovascular disease are so good that I have genuine questions over whether it's ethical to withhold treatment from people as soon as their LDL is even above fucking 120. I'm like, is this even I would jab a kid with a PSK9 inhibitor. Like fucking two jab, it's like, oh, what's that, like, finger, like that little heel prick test they do for like phenylketonuria and other kind of conditions at birth. It's like, and also jab them with a PSK9 inhibitor. Like the idea, but think about it this way. The drugs are so good. We could eradicate the burden of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease from the population. That raises a really interesting ethical dilemma. Mm. Like, we can eradicate the leading cause of death, like, by removing the causal risk factor. You wouldn't eradicate it entirely, because there are, of course, other causes. But, like, you would drop events and mortality exponentially. There were probably, other than conditions like polio, you're talking about that level of eradication of a disease. And yet when it comes to obesity, this is, more than anything, the most difficult in all of, I think, biological sciences, the most difficult aspect to try and address, because the available interventions, which typically are lifestyle, are horrendous for their return on investment. Because you're sending people out into this environment where they don't have access to a fucking park, and they work two jobs, and they've genetic predisposition to cardiometabolic disease, and they're stressed to fuck, and they've poor resources. and Matthew Saeed thinks they just need a little bit of willpower, or the Western civilization is going to fall. Like, it's, we don't talk about a condition like any other way. There's no other, whether it's cardiovascular disease, diabetes, anything else, we do not discuss those conditions and the excellent benefit medications provide in that way. So it's a moral distinction, not a biological distinction. But yet, with weight loss and weight maintenance, not everyone needs to necessarily lose weight, but for those that are in that high risk category, this is the hardest thing to achieve in biological sciences. And yet we're moralizing the first drug that's ever been fucking effective. First, mm-hmm. This is like, the leptin gene was just,
deal.
Yeah. Like, leptin was what, 1994, they discovered leptin and thought, fuck, finally, we can develop an intervention, a pharmacological intervention to help people with excess adiposity that is a risk for their health long-term to lose that. And that was a failure. And possibly because it was just only effective in people that had like leptin deficiency, but also highlighting the complexity, the neurobiology that is underpinning people who end up with a BMI of 38, 39, 40. And this is the first genuinely effective intervention. And we're having a societal song and a fucking dance about it. It's fucking pathetic. It's
no,
like, shut the fuck up.
It truly is wild. It really is. I'm still a little bit embarrassed that I'd argue with that guy for like 2.5 hours. I just couldn't let it go though. I couldn't let it go.
Yeah.
And I think it's because not only do you see it from people who have no freaking idea, who have never worked with anyone who, like, never worked with people with obesity before, but just have something to say about it, just have, like, an opinion that they feel as though is worthy of sharing. But even from, like, personal trainers, you know, who they've potentially worked with lots of people who have been living with obesity and who have seen them struggle, and they still have capital T, capital A, the audacity to sit there and go, I think people are just being lazy. And it's just sort of like, first of all, hon.
Well, that's, we know where that's coming from in PT culture.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, there are plenty who are educated enough and who are, and that goes both ways, right? Educated enough to know that they don't know. And also educated enough to know that it's actually a net positive instead of, like you said, like the collapse of Western society as we know it. But it's, you know, coming from, I mean, I've even seen nutrition coaches saying things like that. And it's just sort of like, you've entirely missed the point. You know, it's just phenomenal. And the fact that you, like, I'm sorry that you think that your job's at risk, but ultimately you should have more tools in your tool belt than just putting people in a calorie deficit. And if that's all you have, that's on you. That is not on them. Like, you're an idiot.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an advancement that is still going to be available to, you know, a few people.
Exactly.
You know, I can't walk out onto the street and get a statin. Like, this is a medication. Like, this isn't something that people are just going to be like, oh, cool. It's like fucking muscle food. I'll just order it along with my macro counted, you know, meal plan. I think that kind of, I guess, hesitation maybe that people have because they think something like this essentially makes them obsolete. It's like, it does if you're an idiot.
Yes. That's so true. You made yourself relevant just by being thick.
Yeah. If you're an idiot, you're obsolete. You're already obsolete. It's just
you were the last to know
in an area where there's so much demand. Yeah. and again, like you know, and are doing, and Spencer, it's like people who aren't fucking idiots about this will be like, this is great. Will work with this.
Yeah,
and will help people. Like, semaglutide or other related to drugs don't make calories disappear.
No.
They don't. They help. But people still need to lower energy intake. They still need to have long-term strategies in place to maintain where they get with the drug. They still need, for other reasons of health, to be able to develop good nutrition habits. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, you can take semaglutide and eat Twinkies, but you might end up with diabetes. probably not with weight loss, but you could end up with cardiovascular disease. You know, like, it's this idea people divorce, and this is the problem with, you know, hashtag calorie fucking deficit, is that people then really conflate the concepts here between, again, sustaining an outcome that is primarily influenced by energy balance versus, well, what happens after this 16 weeks and what happens to someone's long-term health relative to the diet that they're eating, because that's where the actual composition of that individual's diet comes into play. And so there's always going to be room for people to need to have appropriate guidance so that they're not actually losing that weight, drinking bulletproof coffee, and having a bunch of plaque decide to accumulate in their arteries. Anyone who thinks that this is like them going out of business is an idiot.
Well, and I think it's the same, thread. Obviously, two very different concepts, but it's the same thing. As I was on a call once with a developer of a calorie counting app, and he was like, well, and I would never okay the use of, like, I would never put AI into this artificial because I don't want to make you guys redundant. And I was like, you've never worked with real people before. You have no idea what real bang average human beings are like, because you are in a vacuum of bodybuilders. And for those of you tuning in and listening along, bodybuilders are those guys. You give them some numbers, they will go do it. They are happy to go do it. They are very, very type A, very numbers focused, very, very adherent. It's sort of like if I said you can only eat you can only eat whole grain rice when it's a full moon, the rest of the time you have to eat white rice, they'd probably go for it.
Yeah.
So he's sitting here going, well, artificial intelligence in calorie counting apps will make you guys redundant. I'm like, again, if you think that that's all that I do, you would think that I would be made redundant. If you think that that's the only thing that I add to my client's day is just recalculating their calories when they've dropped a bit of body fat, like, you're entirely missing the point of what just having some human fucking interaction is great. Saying that you ate one extra piece of cake and you feel bad that you did that, and having a place to go and say that and voice that and not feel like you're going to get tut-tutted for it. You can't do that with GLP-1 or with an app with AI in it. You don't get that kind of, experience with these. It's just like, again, it's amazing. It's sort of like more information and just even like greasing the wheels physiologically, like with what GLP-1 do. It's still not the whole picture. It's still not everything. It is a complex problem that requires not even necessarily like complex solutions, but maybe multiple pronged approaches that will look different for everybody. You know, there will be people who go on GLP-1s and never speak to a nutrition coach once and they'll have excellent outcomes. Fantastic. There'll be people who are on GLP-1s and they are having a hard time figuring out, like, them and their provider are having a difficult time figuring out the dose, who will stick with the nutrition coach through the whole process because they just, it's that little bit added support. It really just does depend. But the final point that we like kind of touched on this a bit ago is the concept of like, everyone thinks that they're so special. I remember my 7th grade English teacher, Mr. Judas, the irony. He had this t-shirt that he always wore. That's like, you're like a snowflake. You're special, just like everybody else. And yeah, I feel brilliant. Like, that's always stuck with me, where it's sort of like, we all are unique, and at the same exact time, we are all the same. There's not actually a big difference here, but obviously a huge, huge uptake at the minute in my Instagram ads and everyone else's is this concept of personalized nutrition in varying degrees.
My Instagram ads are all for like techno events. I'm really not joking.
I believe you.
Oh, thank God I'm not seeing ads for personalized nutrition.
Oh no, I get it a lot. I don't know what I've done to deserve that. I was a bad person in my past life.
Yeah. Is this Zoe stuff?
I will nod along, but Not Nutrition Gurus does not have a legal budget.
Okay.
I'm scared to say. But even, you know, the concept of, is it nutrigenetic? Whatever. But like, essentially, even like getting tested, your genes tested as to how well you tolerate carbohydrate.
Well, that is nutrigenetics is the concept.
Nutrigenetics. Yeah. Yes. I think, and obviously companies like Zoe, for example, are also in, you know, really perpetuating this concept of, you are exceptionally unique in how you process foods. And I remember the last time I really like picked up a study about this was around like nutrigenetics, but this was like a few years ago now. So it's equally advanced, and also nothing has changed at the same time. Where I remember reading this study, and it was sort of like, again, you get to the end and they're kind of like, so basically, eat a wide variety of vegetables, eat lean proteins. Dude, it's sort of like, well, would you have told them to do that if you hadn't had tested their DNA? Like, could you have made a safe bet and said that irrespective of what their, or irregardless of what their DNA told you.
Mm-hmm.
So did you even need to fucking bother? Because right. It's looking like, no.
And this is, yeah, we did a, is it out yet? Maybe it's out. So Danny and myself did a podcast episode recently. Maybe it's not out yet, on personalized nutrition. And we've kind of shat on it. For reasons that are, I think, are entirely justified. So the promise of personalized nutrition is that you can take an individual's genetic data, you can take other health data, and you can kind of combine it all into an algorithm, essentially, that will be able to predictively influence someone's health by getting them to adopt certain changes. And the main sell of it on paper is that it's predictive in nature, or so they say, as opposed to typically what happens is someone comes to you, they already have, you know, a lot of weight to lose. They already have high cholesterol, they have high blood pressure, whatever. They're pre-diabetic. And at that point, what you're doing is an intervention, but it's reactive. It's to try to turn this situation around. But when you actually look at some of the studies in this area, like there's one big trial called the Food for Me trial, multi-site trial across a couple of groups in Europe. And they had general healthy eating guidance and then three levels of personalized nutrition. One was just personalized nutrition, so to speak, based on someone's dietary data. So bear in mind that what you do is personalized nutrition in the actual sense of the term. What a dietitian or nutrition professional does is personalized nutrition, because you are working with that individual. You're finding out what they like, what they don't like, what their history is, all that kind of stuff. But so that was the first level, essentially, was using their dietary information to give them personalized individual guidance. Then the second level added their genetic information on top of this. And then the third level added both genetic and phenotype information on top of this. And what was hilarious was that, like, none of the additional fancy bolts and whistles were any more effective at dietary changes than just giving someone good personalized nutrition advice based on their diet history. And then even more hilarious was that the changes that were made were like minuscule changes, all entirely in line with what our current guidelines recommend. So they were like, personalized nutrition led to a reduction in salt intake and a reduction in saturated fat and red meat intake. And it's like, oh yeah? Oh yeah, it did it?
Life-changing.
Yeah, right. Wow. Fuck.
Wow.
We're the dietary guidelines are obsolete. You know, it's, and this isn't just the Food for Me trial. This is, you know, let's take these algorithms that something like Zoe is using, or there's another group in Israel did a big study. Okay, so this is the methodological fuckery that's going on in the personalized nutrition trials. Let me put it to you this way. Imagine before I do an intervention, I take you and a bunch of other people, and I do all this testing on you, and I find out how you're currently eating, and I find out what diet you'd best like to go on, and I find out how this would actually influence your blood cholesterol levels. And then after finding all of that information, I then put you on that diet. And then 12 weeks later, your cholesterol comes down. I go, oh my God, look at how good personalized nutrition was. It's like, what? You found out before what was going to benefit. Now, in this case, personalized nutrition has almost exclusively been used with blood glucose as the main variable, not just even blood glucose, actually. It's continuous glucose monitoring or monitoring interstitial glucose. But glucose levels is the primary thing they're honing in on. And so diabetes-related outcomes, glycemic control outcomes are primarily what they're focused on. So when you actually look at what these algorithms, so they're taking all this data from continuous glucose monitoring and feeding it into an algorithm. And this algorithm is then recommending a diet that's so personalized, and people are going on that diet and losing weight or improving blood glucose management. And then you look at what the algorithms told them to do, and it's basically just eat less carbs. And it's like, oh, wow, okay, fancy algorithm. And what was hilarious, in one trial in Israel, they had the algorithm compared to a dietitian that also had all of this information about patients in front of them. And the dietitian was just as effective at recommending dietary changes that were predictive of improvements in blood glucose levels as the algorithm with all the bells and whistles. So I think personalized nutrition genuinely at this point is practically a con as far as the evidence is so underwhelming and these commercialized programs are so far out over their skis on the evidence, they are fucking in another stratosphere. They're not in reality. And I even went on the Zoe website to fuck around out of interest and like,
oh, it's horrifying. I put in
it's the worst.
Scary place.
I put in a bunch of information. And the next minute I was being told that there was a 19% chance that I have this bacteria in my gut, but I need to send them my shit just to find out, right?
Oh, good Lord.
I just gave you my age and where I lived and my name. Weight and a couple of other like basic measures. And the next minute they're telling me, you know, there's a 19% chance I have this bacteria. And I was like, this is total bullshit. Everything about this. I think it's a scam, if I'm being honest.
I feel like that it's really difficult as a coach who does quote unquote individualized nutrition coaching. It's exceptionally difficult to sit and say, yeah, but what we do is personalized, because when you look at it, it's the implementation truly that is what is actually personalized. Every single one of my clients is working towards eating more veggies and probably increasing protein unless they're, you know, already there, or moving a little bit more, finding exercise they enjoy, working on stress management, getting better sleep hygiene. None of that is a fucking secret, but no one is doing it in the same way because not all of them are in the same place or have the same number of kids or have the same job or have, you know, menopause, no menopause, man, woman, you know, it all of their life circumstances are very different. So it's the implementation that is personalized. And, you know, I even wonder then, like, if they also did the algorithm versus like a dietitian that you chose, because half of it is it's a relationship. It's a coaching client relationship. Yeah. And if you get on, you get on well with that person, you're more likely to stay and to stick it out, to see those changes, to see those outcomes. And, sure. You know, if you were in a trial where the sales pitch is, it's personalized, it's an algorithm, it sounds fancy and shiny and new, are you not more likely to stick to it for those 12 weeks? Because at the end of the day, anyone can do anything for 12 weeks. It's not that long. You can knuckle down and do anything. You could do anything for 12 weeks. Like, if I took a cold shower every single day, I'm like, well,
yeah,
11 weeks and 6 days left, that's fine. I'll suck it up.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, if you're being sold this thing that's packaged up in a really shiny outer casing, you're going to want to do it more.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it is just, yeah, eat veggies. You guys, like, that's eat veggies and have richer parents is basically eat less butter, have richer parents, move more.
Eat less butter, don't be poor, and you'll be
no
fine.
Pombos allowed,
no excuses.
Oh, and also probably be a man,
hustle.
Grind harder, bro.
Grind harder.
Get better genetics.
Yeah, yeah. Get better genetics and be less poor, and hurt, and hurry up.
Yes. Oh, and it's your fault. Oh, dear.
You weren't responsible enough in your early 20s. Yeah.
No. What? It's Maggie Thatcher would be extremely disappointed in you.
No, she would be devastated. My idol.
My idol.
Yeah.
Okay, if you haven't watched it already. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say I have a framed photograph of her.
Good. If you've never watched it, just type into YouTube, The Vivian and Bag of Chips Snatch Game. So two drag queens on RuPaul's Drag Race go back and forth as Donald Trump and Maggie Thatcher. Chef's kiss, the most unbelievable thing you've ever seen, because they're both so accurate and so funny.
Wait, are they impersonating them?
Yes.
Wow.
And It's so, good.
What am I typing in?
I'll send it to you. This is really important information that I feel like is,
this is
really relevant.
Yeah.
So the final question that I have for you, Alan, it's a funny one. So if you're not, what is the funniest, weirdest, or best health fad that you've ever participated in?
I mean, I guess when I first, like, this is the funny thing for me about kind of ending, like, before there was even social media, like before any of this was even a thing, I like took this to its most extreme. 2009, 10, 11. So there was about a 4-year period where I ruthlessly tracked pretty much every part of my life, constantly walked around at a ludicrous percentage of body fat. Which had all sorts of detrimental knock-on effects. Hindsight, I'm just like, wow. And at the time was very, very, very much into what at that time was like called paleo. I don't even know that it necessarily, I look back on it now and I'm like, actually, that was kind of sensible in terms of where that movement went. Like at the time, it was like, just eat sweet potatoes as opposed to white potatoes and don't eat processed foods and kind of eat more protein. And it was kind of like, this seems entirely reasonable to me. But I definitely went pretty hardcore on like the low carb side of it. And yeah. And the thing was, and I trigger warning, I guess, like I'm just a bit weird and also obsessive. So I actually loved it in a sick way. Like I used to get such a kick out of getting that like hunger growl at night before bed, like a real sick kick out of it, because so I'd get really excited then for what the scales would say the next morning. And I would weigh myself religiously every morning and take the average. And I had a spreadsheet in which I had measurements for almost pretty much every part of my body. So yeah, like I was, this is before fucking Instagram was even a thing. I had been there, done that, bought the t-shirt and burnt the t-shirt before I was even like more interested, before I was even more interested in the science. To be fair, that's probably one of the factors that got me interested in reading more of the kind of science side originally. Yeah, I was, for that period of my life, I was very hardcore obsessive with body composition, diet, rigorously controlling all of it, but genuinely loving it in this really sick fucking way. Really, really. I've relaxed over the years, I think.
Well, that's good to know. I think that, you know, everyone can kind of like trip and fall down the rabbit hole, but like in their very own unique way. God, if I saw that like come across my desk, it's like, I want you to coach me. I'd be like, oh God, like, how do I even start to like unpick this? Because the first thing I do would be like, when someone's into everything that much, you can't just turn around and be like, you have to stop tracking everything. Yeah. You have to go cold turkey, because you can't at that point, right?
Right.
Like,
aye.
You have to start unraveling it.
And
but
here's
the
funny thing. I thought of,
Oh, go ahead.
I thought a lot about, because the weaning off process was very much a process.
100%.
It kind of phased out itself naturally. And it phased out because I got interested more in cooking. So I'd always made my own food, obviously being this kind of upset. I still did eat out, but like with all these like hacks and strategies. And so part of it was because I'd done that for a long time. I was starting to just become a bit more interested in cooking for the enjoyment of cooking. So it started as simple as I still tracked everything breakfast to dinner, but then I didn't track anything related to dinner. I just made whatever recipe I wanted to make that evening. And then it's like, oh, I'm not morbidly obese already. Okay. So cognitively you're like, oh, I can relax a little bit. And And then it just kind of really expanded from there to the point where I stopped tracking altogether, but I still kept tabs on like my, I stopped tracking food, but I was still tracking body composition and weight. And then I kind of stopped tracking that. And then suddenly emphasis changes. I got kind of more into powerlifting and realized that I actually probably could put on some weight. I was, because I'm 6 foot flat, but at the time I was so lean, I was like 82.3 kilos. So whereas I'm 95 now and I'm a lot more like physically, I look like my frame fits a bit more. Yeah. So that's kind of like in genuinely, I was 13 kilos lighter than I am now. Like it was it was obscene. But so it was a really interesting process over about a 2 year period of starting from I'm just not tracking dinner anymore to not tracking at all to having no hangups about foods anymore at all. And to just having that now be a kind of interesting period of my life that I look at with some fondness and some hilarity.
Yeah. Wow. That's what
but I did collapse after 4 days on one Ibiza trip because I had like so little in the tank, but I also hadn't slept. So I don't recommend being like very, very lean and trying to, you know, do what I did.
Party for 48 hours straight. Minimal hydration.
It's more like 72, but yeah. 72. Oh no, there was plenty of hydration.
Oh dear. I mean, yeah. It, you know, that's the stuff that I find really interesting is sort of like taking an individual in front of you and like moving them closer to where you want to be, because like I could track everything and like 3 weeks later I'll be like, I've had enough, I've got what I needed to out of this, put this down and never look at it again. Like my obsessive personality obviously comes out in much different ways, but it's really interesting, isn't it? Well, it is to me anyway.
Yeah,
but well, this has been a marathon, Alan.
Yeah, it has. What are we at time wise? I don't know. Oh shit,
2 hours.
Okay, good. I have another podcast at 3:30, so
oh my god. You definitely need a leg stretch. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat today about everything and for sharing your knowledge and really making a conceited effort to sort of give nutrition research the onus that it deserves, but seemingly does not have at the moment.
Shredding it of credibility.
Yeah, but I think like, you know, you can't be in the middle of something and not have critique for what it is, because then
the point? Absolutely.
Like there's then it's just a pile of nothingness. It's like, no, everything's fine. It's like, no, that's psychotic. Mm. Everything can be a bit better at one point or another.
Mm. I agree.
But that's a nice motivating. Motivating end to the podcast. But yes, I will in the show notes, I will put everywhere you can find Alan and his website, and I have to say Alenia and Alan's Instagram. If you have a general interest in nutrition, probably not for you. If you are a personal trainer or nutrition coach who wants to do better, definitely for you. And if you're getting your master's in nutrition, for you. The average person, it's not for you. And it's not because you're not very intelligent, but because it is a skill. Oh, dear.
Thank you. I will take that as a compliment.
Oh, hopefully I meant it as one. I'm not trying to roast you.
Well, thank you for having me. I have enjoyed this.
Thank you for coming on.
It's been great.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this part two episode with Dr. Alan Flanagan. Once again, if you haven't listened to part one, I would highly recommend it. Another juicy, information-filled episode.
Equally, I do want to say as well, when I asked Ellen what I thought would kind of be a funny question, because I ask all my guests, like, what fitness fad they fell into, I truly was not expecting his answer. And, you know, hindsight is always 20/20, isn't it? He shared something that was realistically quite vulnerable. And I don't think I handled it to the best of my capabilities. So, you know, there is certainly always opportunity for growth and learning. And one final thing to leave you with, please rate and review this podcast on whatever app or platform you're listening, because it is exceptionally helpful for me and Not Nutrition Gurus and all of the cool guests that I have lined up to get traction, get out there. I really do believe in trying to make sort of health and fitness rhetoric and information and education both kind of like funny and entertaining, but also accessible. And this is a lot of the reason why I do a free podcast. So please, if you're enjoying them, it would mean a lot to me to have you rate and review. I look forward to speaking with you next week. Next week's guest is Jeb Stuart Johnson, and he is hilarious and he has such an interesting view on the world and is an exceptionally good coach. So I think that you will really, really enjoy that episode. So subscribe and tune in. Alrighty. Have a good day.